And no one taught it to me this way. And I was like, how is that possible? Like, we don't have a solid framework for why people are getting super sick. And so I think I figured it out.
Hey, and welcome to another episode of my podcast, and thank you for joining. This show gives you updated knowledge and tools for better well-being, brain health, mental performance, and longevity. You know, I understand your time is valuable, so the goal is to pack these episodes with the latest in science, interesting and inspiring ideas, and actionable tools with my expert guests. If you want to stay updated on new episodes, subscribe to YouTube, Spotify, and Apple Podcast, and sign up to my newsletter, inkaland.co/newsletter. In this episode, Dr. Molly Malouf is debunking some myths on health and offering what I think is a clearer, women-specific and more comprehensive approach to health. So woman, if you want to stay fit and healthy without burning yourself out with extreme fasting and countless freezing cold plunges, this episode is for you. Dr. Molly Malouf is a medical doctor, Stanford lecturer, female expert on health and founder and CEO of biotech company Adama Bioscience. For 3 years, she taught a pioneering course on health span in the wellness department of the medical school at Stanford University. She's been a consultant for more than 50 companies in the digital health, consumer health, and biotechnology industries. And her new book, The Spark Factor, is one of the first female-targeted biohacking books out there. I think it's a great overview on biohacks specifically for women. It's very detailed and offers good balance of science and practical tools for starting biohacking as a woman. Me and Dr. Malouf talk about biohacking for women from various aspects and how to do it safely. We also cover blood sugar balance and how it relates to some less talked aspects like microbiome, LDL, and inflammation and stress. We cover fasting and cold plunges and when to do them and when not to do them. We cover the importance of self-compassion and even self-love in health and sickness. So I'd love to hear what you thought about the topics mentioned in this episode and what are your some personal experiences with them, like blood glucose tracking, fasting, and other biohacks. So comment your thoughts below and let me know. And if you like these topics, subscribe to the channel as well. It's always nice to know that there is a person on the other side of the screen or the audio stream listening and getting benefits from these episodes, and that motivates me to do more. And if you think someone else could benefit from the topics in this episode, please consider forwarding this episode to them and spreading health. I would also be very grateful if you could go to iTunes and give the podcast a 5-star rating. This supports the podcast's visibility and helps other people to find these episodes as well. So with that said, thanks for your presence today and enjoy the episode. Molly Malouf, I'm so excited to speak with you today. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
I've been following you for years. I think what you bring out there is amazing. You have a very wide knowledge of pretty much everything in relation to biohacking and brain enhancement and health, but also very specific to female health and mitochondria and insulin balance and all of it from body to psychology to the spirit. And
thank
that
you.
That's why I'm so excited for today's podcast, because I think we're going to have a lot of very cool insights. And I've just recently finished your book, Spark Factor, which is a program tailored to women to maximize their energy potential to live as long and healthy as possible. I love it.
Thanks.
So, okay, so let's go a little bit about your background.
Sure.
You're a doctor, but you're also a biohacker. So what's your story on becoming a biohacker and why did you end up writing a book about it?
So when I first started my career in Silicon Valley, I was kind of known as this doctor innovator who was working with startups. You know, I started working with early stage companies really early in my career when I first started my practice. And I basically was, you know, putting blood sugar monitors on my body and trying to figure out what was going on, because I was doing some consulting for a company that was developing a tool that was going to be a microneedle approach to CGM, which is continuous glucose monitoring. And I was presenting at the Quantified Self meetup. And I remember getting approached by this guy who wanted to hire me for his company called GeneSolve. And I ended up joining the company, and it was basically creating personalized nutrition and personalized hormones for Silicon Valley elite. It was a pretty cool company, actually. Like, we took genetics and laboratory data and questionnaire data, and we created an expert system that optimized health. And it actually worked really well. And at the time, I was like kind of just getting into branding myself. It was like 2014, 2015. And this guy I was working for, I was like, I think I should really come out as a biohacker. And he was like, no, you don't want to be a biohacker because that means you have to go around the system to get what you want. And I was like, but that's what I'm doing with my practice. I'm like trying to go around the system to get people optimal health instead of just fixing sickness. I was really interested in how do you measure lots of different biomarkers, and then how do you use that data to improve your health? How to make better decisions that are personalized to your body. And I was so impressionable that at the time that I kind of listened to him. But in 2017, I started really putting my personal brand together. And I just realized that like I had a lot of knowledge. I mean, like you said, I'm weirdly very skilled in lots of different areas. Like, I spent so much time studying metabolism. And then I spent a lot of time the last few years studying psychology and studying spirituality. And so the holistic model to me is still very like powerful. I really also believe in the biopsychosocial model of health, but I've spent a lot of time studying Chinese medicine, naturopathic medicine, allopathic medicine, somatic work, like you name it. I mean, I've dug into it, herbal medicine, wearable technology, precision medicine, personalized medicine. Like I've done it all. And it's been a really fun journey because I've been able to make a lot of cool discoveries, see a lot of patterns, and get to do a lot of research, just because my practice was designed to optimize the health of people who really wanted to learn about their bodies. So I got to do that firsthand. And 10 years later, after starting my practice, I'm now publishing my first book. It's really based on my practice and the Stanford course that I taught for 3 years on optimizing health and reducing, insulin resistance, and really teaching people about how the very core problems in most of our health and modern society relate to mitochondrial dysfunction and insulin resistance as a result of our lifestyles that, break our metabolisms. And if we let that happen, we end up getting heart disease, cancer, diabetes, dementia, the biggest killers. And so I wrote this book trying to also explain to women that, like, there's a lot of different ways to biohack, but a lot of things that work for guys don't work the same for women. And if you layer too many biohacks on, you're going to end up with side effects and you may end up screwing up your hormones. And so, I was really trying to get across this fact that we have a biological imperative that's a little bit different than men. We actually really are, responsible for creating and propagating life. And men obviously play a part in that, but women have the babies and women have fertility and have like a very deep connection to like creation. Because if we are in an environment of high stress and lots of anxiety, like it can actually affect our fertility. Our body will send the signals to our body that we need to survive, not reproduce. And there's also all sorts of other things in the book about just sort of like the basics and fundamentals of biohacking and what you want to watch out for and what you want to, and when what should you not biohack? Like, what are things that you would not want to do? Like, for example, a lot of people are into fasting, but fasting under extreme stress is just going to make you stop your hormones, or screw up your periods. So it's so important for people to realize that you don't want to overdo biohacks, and you want to know if it's right for your body. And you may not need to do all the things that men do, and that's okay. And that doesn't mean you can't do other things. But a lot of women just they dig into so many different health interventions. Their body fat can drop too low, and then they can stop their period. And it's like, you got to first and foremost maintain your hormone health, and that's really your hormones are really a beautiful window into how you're adapting to the world around you. So I have a whole chapter on hormone health, and I really want women to get to know their bodies and really understand how their bodies change over their lifespan. And that's a big, yeah, it's a big part of the book.
I love that. I love all of it. And I love that you mentioned the fact that, you may not want to do all the biohacks out there, especially, the problem with the medical system is, as you said, it treats the disease and it does not, it generalizes a lot. So you have a disease model and then you have a cure for it that is
applied to everyone, basically. Okay, then we have this biohacking field in which we have like a preventive healthcare almost. So we're trying to prevent the illness and improve and enhance our health. And we still have the trends. We have like ketogenic diet or 16-8 fast or blah, blah, blah. If we start to applying these to everyone, we are not any better than the medical system, you know, because we have to take care of the, but we need to take into consideration the bio individuality and the femininity and women hormones, as you said. So like, if we go into one generalization into other from medical generalizations to biohacking generalizations, it's pretty much the same outcome disease, or not optimal outcomes for sure. And so I want to go into all of these women biohacks and the book. It's really a great book. Like, I think it's the most comprehensive biohacking for women book. Well, I think it's the first one actually that I
It
saw.
might be one of
Yeah, it's
the
probably the first one, but it's also super comprehensive. So it's definitely the place to start if you
Yeah.
are a woman and want to like go into biohacking. But I want to know, what do you think, like, before we go into that? Yeah, the first thing that I want to know, like, do you have a personal story with this?
Sure. I would say that, like, I knew as a child when I was going through puberty, I was like, someday I'm gonna understand what is going on inside my body right now. Like, I remember thinking, this is so weird. I don't understand what's going on, and I'm gonna figure this out. And that was like me in seventh grade and sixth, seventh grade. And then I get to high school and I start playing with supplements. And I mean, I remember, experimenting with different, different nutraceuticals I could find at the natural food store. And I was always trying to improve. I was always trying to like be, I was always trying to have an edge, obviously. And I really worked myself hard into the just over and over again. I would burn out in my youth. Like I think I burned out maybe three times in this lifetime, which is probably
Wow.
not a good
Okay.
sign. But it was enough. I mean, like you push yourself so hard and you break yourself a few times and you're like, I need to figure this out, So I get to medical
Yeah.
school and I'm like I'm in a pretty dire state. I'm miserable. I'm like, this is so hard. I don't know if I want to continue. This is just impossible. And I went to a psychologist and he was like, you're not depressed, you're not anxious, you're just a stressed out medical student who's not taking care of herself. And I was like, great. So I started to do research on, what do I need to do to get healthy? So I started doing yoga. I st stopped, doing all-nighters. I stopped drinking cups and cups of espresso. I started spending time with my family and my friends. I started eating more consistently. I stopped having cereal for meals. Like, I mean, I was not healthy at the time. And my performance started to improve pretty significantly. And I went from an average on my step one to a 99th percentile on my step two in the course of, I think it was really like a year, but it was about 6 to 8 months of actual change, lifestyle changes that really led to improving my test anxiety and improving my overall just, performance in school. And when I did so much better on my second board exam, my peers were like, what did you do? How did you do this? And I was like, started changing my lifestyle. And they're like, will you teach us? And I was like, you know what? Yeah. And so I went to the family medicine department and I created a course and I got all these, great doctors who were experts in different aspects of optimizing health, like sleep and movement and integrated medicine, acupuncture and relationships and food as medicine. And I got all these people to come teach. And so I created my first course and I ended up winning a bunch of humanitarian awards for it, which was cool. And then you get to your residency and you're just like, there's really no way to be healthy as a resident. It's just really hard. And the sad thing about the healthcare system is that like a lot of doctors really are suffering pretty terribly. And there's just not a lot of time for them to actually dedicate to optimizing their own health and actually taking care of themselves because you're working these crazy hours. So when I got my license and started working in Silicon Valley, I was like, I'm going to build a medical practice and it's going to optimize health instead of just fix sickness. And I certainly was doing personalized medical research as one of the first things I learned how to do because I was working for a company. And I literally created this whole system of how do you use data to drive decisions. And so I was basically biohacking all these executives that I was working with and trying to solve their healthcare problems using research, And Then I really built my own practice and started working with executives who wanted to optimize their health. And, you know, at the very beginning, I knew enough to be able to help people, but I certainly was kind of using my practice as like a laboratory. And I got really, really concurrently very interested in technology and wearable technology and laboratory testing. And so I kind of cut my teeth as both an innovator working with startups, but also working with executives as a private doctor. So I've worked with like over 50 companies in the last 10 years. And so I just started really creating my own products and developing my own systems and creating my own, you know, my own inventions and things like that, which is cool. But the more and more you put yourself in the media, the more and more you open yourself up to judgment, which is something I'm learning to deal with. But, you know, I ended up teaching at Stanford for a few years and then moved to Austin. And now I'm in full entrepreneurship mode and full book promotion mode. And like, I have to say, it feels really good to like be 10 years later after starting my career and really being like, oh my God, everyone thought I was crazy at the time. And now everyone's like, oh yeah, she totally was ahead of her time. So it's nice to get that feedback, but it's been a challenging journey because a lot of people didn't see what I was doing was real. They thought it was kind of, you know, they just didn't see that it was like a real movement. And now everyone's really catching on. So I'm lucky that I got to be part of it early and I've been able to make a lot of mistakes and be able to learn from those mistakes. But it's been a boys club for a long time, as Silicon Valley really was. And, you know, fortunately I got to be friends with some of these guys. Dave Asprey wrote the foreword of my book and I've just been really lucky to have great mentors and people who can teach me. And then, you know, at the end of the day, you got to figure out a lot of things on your own.
Well, I'm like, big fan of you staying true to yourself, even though people outside may say that, hey, like, what are you doing? This is weird. Like, this is not what we do in the general practice. Yeah. And this is a story for many biohackers who are failing to find the solutions in the medical system, start to do their own thing, and people are just criticizing, which is a little bit sad. I mean, we should be really like open to whatever way works for you. And, you know, really self-discovery is the key to start optimizing your health. So, yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, if, for example, to your Instagram, you do so much impact at the moment for women and men alike. You help people to optimize their health. So, like, thank you for staying true to yourself and keep educating people, because this is very important what you do.
Appreciate it. It means a lot. It's nice to hear that.
So, what is your definition of health?
Sure. I believe, well, so when I first started practicing, health was the WHO's definition, the complete absence of disease or infirmary. And then I was like, since when does no one ever get sick? Since when do we not get challenged with, you know, with like health issues, you know, like very, very, very few people are perfectly optimally well. It's kind of almost an impossible, you know, measurement point. So I started looking at some of the Scandinavian research. And I mean, I would argue that a lot of really great research around health comes from other countries, not America, because there's a lot of countries that are really more invested in health as a movement, like Singapore, like, you know, a lot of the Scandinavian countries, a lot of Europe. But basically, I believe health is the ability to adapt and self-manage in the face of adversity, which means it's like your body's ability to handle stress and not break. And so it's your, and biohacking is really about optimizing health, because not only are you trying to create a stronger, more resilient body, but you're also trying to be able to, if you do get hit with something that's challenging, sit faster than you would be able to fix it if you just went through mainstream medicine. So like I got COVID about a month ago, maybe 2 months ago, end of September. I guess it's the beginning of November. So, you know, a little bit over a month ago. And I was like, uh-oh, this is not a good one. I was not feeling really great with it. It was not awesome. So, I mean, I was in bed for a week and I had just got back from Burning Man. So I was like definitely extra tired. And so I went and I did ozone. And then a few weeks later, I went and did NAD plus therapy for 5 days in Sedona and started some peptides. And holy crap, I felt better than going into getting COVID. And since doing all those biohacks, My heart rate variability has gone up like 30 points. So like
oh, that's amazing.
I not only adapt
for NAD, from NAD or?
I think the NAD made the biggest shift for sure.
Yeah.
And I also think that I needed to, I mean, I ran all my labs because I was like, I was definitely like, okay, it's time to just really work on this stuff. So I was like, what I typically will do a few times a year is like run all my tests. So I started running my labs and I started, I was like, oh crap, my cortisol levels are way too high in the morning. And I was like, all right, now I need to cut back on the heavy lifting. I need to stop doing so much HIIT training. I need to like, I mean, I wasn't doing a lot of HIIT training at all. I was maybe doing it maybe once every 2 weeks. So I was just like looking at my weightlifting though. And I was doing pretty heavy lifts in the morning. And I was starting to notice that that was making me a little bit more stressed out. I started cutting back on caffeine. I started weaning off of coffee. I started upping at the adaptogens. I started eating more carbs because I do cycle in and out of ketosis. And I was just giving my body more rest and giving my body more recovery and just giving my body the ability to recover. And it was all of those things that I did in response to getting sick and getting data about my body that made me realize like, hey, this is what health is about. It's like, the thing that sucks is that like, not everybody has just access to this information like I do. Like I have wearable technology where I can see my blood sugar and my heart rate variability in real time. I have access to labs. I have access to, you know, really good information. And I think what I'm doing is like basically where everyone's going to be in 5 to 10 years. There's a big movement towards regenerative medicine. I was really, really hesitant about it until I needed it, until I got sick. And I was like, okay, I need to regenerate. And I did it all. And I was like, okay, this stuff is the next level biohacking. I mean, now you're seeing people like Elon Musk and Kim Kardashian and all these people on Wegovy. They're on these like GLP-1 inhibitors. There's so much stuff happening in peptides. And like, you know, it's becoming really commonplace for people to start using red light therapy. I do regret not putting red light therapy in the book because I totally forgot about it, but it is one of the bigger biohacks. There's so much in the book that I couldn't fit it all in, but I definitely
a lot. Yeah.
I mean, it's a really thorough book. It's like, yes. But I kind of figured like, if I'm going to write a book, it's not, I mean, like some people write a book on one topic and all they do is like, this is how you lower your blood sugar. And that's great because people do need that stuff. But this book is written specifically for people who are like, I want to biohack my body. Give me all the ways I can do that. What do I need to know? You know, that's really the goal of this book is to like get people excited about all the different possibilities of optimizing their health.
Yeah, I mean, I've been in the biohacking women education space for years as well. And like weekly almost, I get a question from someone. I'm really into biohacking. I would like to start. Where should I start?
It's like so important that women don't just jump right into biohacking and be like, okay, fasting, ketosis, HIIT training, mm-mm. sauna, mm-mm. cold plunge. Like you don't want to do all of them all at the same time. And yet men do that and they seem to get ripped, right? But women do that mm-hmm. and we break. Like yeah. Our hormones get dysfunctional, our periods get crazy. And it's like, well, that nobody's really talked about that and why we're different and why we need to be more gentle with our bodies and why we need to listen to our bodies. Like,
right.
I'm in the follicular phase of my periods, so I can hit it harder in the gym. And at the same time, you know, I've made the mistakes of like just doing continuous ketosis and then realizing, oh wow, like this is too much stress on the body. I need to actually eat more carbs. And I had to increase my carbohydrate intake. And I have friends who are like male biohackers. And they were like, you know, I've been eating a lot more carbohydrates and I'm doing so much better in the gym. I'm like, well, that's because you need glycogen to do heavy lifts. And, you know, it's funny because everyone's kind of coming around now to this idea that like, we're not supposed to just necessarily eat one thing all, like, we're not really supposed to have the same diet all the time necessarily. We're supposed to adapt to different, you know, different interventions. Our body likes to adapt. Our body likes to be challenged. Our body likes to change. And if we give it the same signals, it won't, it'll adapt to those signals, but then it'll plateau. So, you know, a big piece of what this book is about is learning to how to adapt and how to use mitohormetic stressors and hormesis is basically how you stress your body a little bit to get stronger. And, you know, using different mitohormetic stressors can actually really boost your health. So breath work is something I'm really passionate about. And I did like a 45-minute long breath work session last night before I went to bed. And it was magical. I mean, it is so powerful, the work that you can do with just your breath. And meditation is such a simple thing that most people don't really commit to. But man, some of the cheapest biohacks are free. You know, like they're just like just meditating and breathing properly. Like those things can change your life. So I talk about those in the book. And then I get into a lot of other obscure topics like trauma, you know, like the role of trauma in our health that a lot of people don't want to talk about, but it's a really big, big problem for a lot of women. And I spent a bunch of time researching trauma, and I wrote a lot about different trauma modalities and the role of connection in health. And, you know, there's so many different facets of biohacking that people don't even think about, but we're spending less and less time with people. And as a result, we're, you know, more and more isolated, and it's becoming problematic for our bodies.
Yeah. So yeah, all of those things are, I think, like for women, it's even, I don't know, somehow more stressful, like stressors are more stressful because we are like, we get more stress naturally through our hormonal cycle. We need to be adapting all the time. So we are all the time put into like these hormetic stress states, basically, throughout our cycle. And it's not like we don't necessarily have to do cold plunging and fasting all the time to get that stress response. We get it pretty naturally. So let's go into the different topics in the book and how women can start biohacking and optimizing their health. First, I think that the first and like foremost question is, as you talk about and you explained about your burnout, and you talk about in the book that women are more and more burnt out. Why are we burnt? Why are we burnt out? Like, what do you think is the root cause of the burnout that we have?
I mean, I think it's a combination of a bunch of things. The first one being, women often are not only working these days, but they're also still responsible for the majority of housework and householding. Mm. And so, you know, not to say that men don't work hard, because they of course do, but women often have to carry both, you know, providing for the family and taking care of the family. And women used to be in like, you know, in society used to be the community leaders. But because we're working so much and still managing the family, there's a big breakdown of the community. And I'm not saying it's women's fault that the communities have broken down by it. By no means, it's actually society's fault. It's like a bigger issue. But because of lack of connection, we don't feel fully safe, because a lot of women are lonely. A lot of women feel very alone in their families. And that's very stressful on the nervous system. Loneliness is like a hunger signal. It's designed to bring you closer to your tribe. And a lot of women, their only tribe they have is their nuclear family. And so some women don't even have that. So now you have a combination of feeling alone, which does activate the HPA axis, and responsibilities that are piling up. So it just becomes a perfect storm of overwhelm. And, you know, like for me, when I got burned out during the pandemic, I mean, 90% of people were burned out at one point. Like it wasn't just me, it was a lot of people. But I remember I was isolated for 3 months during, I was teaching at Stanford online. I was living in Florida and I was by myself, and it wasn't until I realized I was studying animals in research studies. I was studying, how isolation in animals causes depression, causes the nervous system to become highly stressed. And I was sitting there being like, whoa, we're all going through this crazy experiment right now where we're all being isolated, and it's actually breaking a lot of people. And it almost broke me. Fortunately, I was able to do a self-guided mushroom journey. And I cried for like 6 hours, like remember calling my boyfriend at the time. And I was like, oh my God, I'm so hard on myself. I just like, don't take care. I'm like, I expect so much from my body, and when it doesn't perform, I'm so hard on it. And I just really needed to like be so compassionate to myself, because I was like so busy teaching, and I was, you know, I created a company, a supplement company that was creating supplements for COVID that were really great. And I was just piling on too many things. I was just doing too much. Mm-hmm. And that's one of my bigger, you know, problems is like a lot of women just, we do too much and we don't rest enough. We don't recover enough. And so, you know, like I definitely feel like one of the big pieces of the book is like, you really need recovery, and we need a lot more of it than we realize if we want to handle the stresses that we have We need to take vacations. We need to like spend time with people that we trust and love. We need touch. And we need human connection, and we need to connect with ourselves. We need to start with loving who we are. And I mean, it was really after that burnout experience that I was like, you know what? Like, I think I need to you know, get away from this isolation and start spending time with my family and start seeing my friends again and get vaccinated and like go out into the world again. This was like early 2021. Because I was like, this isolation has been horrible for my health. I mean, I think it played a huge role in me burning out, was just not having enough, you know, social support, which is why a big piece of the book is about love and connection. Cause I'm just like, I had to learn that not only did I need more connection, but I also needed way more self-love. And I think that's one of the biggest lessons that the book is trying to really communicate to women, is like, you try so hard to optimize your body. And then when things don't work, if they don't work, you feel like a failure, and then you're harder on yourself. And really what I learned was like, it was self-compassion and kindness and gentleness and like be, yeah, of course, like challenging my body to become stronger is one thing, but sometimes you actually, the biggest challenge you have is to actually learn to recover and to take better care of yourself, to actually not expect so much from yourself. So, you know, heavy biohacking is really a problem if you're already on the cusp of burning out, which is one thing I'm trying to get across in the book. Like, you need to know when you can biohack and when to take a break. And like, if you're strong, fit, healthy, and you've got a lot of reserve, you can start challenging yourself with more, you know, more cold plunges and sauna. Like, I love sauna, but I do a lot less cold plunging when my cortisol's high. And a lot of people are like, oh no, that's when you want a cold plunge. And I'm like, no, trust me. I feel my body after a long cold plunge and it makes me feel worse. And so I'm listening to my body. And if you feel worse after doing something that's supposed to be good for you, that's a really good signal that you probably should take a break. When I first started doing a little bit of fasting in 2018, my body actually felt a lot better because I was insulin resistant, and I had some issues with insulin resistance because, I think it was because of like, I don't know, it was 2018 or 2017, but like my fasting blood sugar was like, right, it was in the 90s, and I really wanted to get into the 80s. I don't think I was fully insulin resistant then, but I definitely needed more metabolic flexibility. It was more like 2014 when I actually had insulin resistance. But it was 2018. I was still having issues in that year of like waking up in the middle of the night and getting really hungry. And I was like noticing that, you know, I definitely needed to make some shifts in my blood sugar metabolism. And so at the time, fasting was great for me, and I really used it as an incredible tool to transform my health. But there was a point where it no longer was working, and it wasn't working because I'd already achieved metabolic flexibility and metabolic health. And when you are already metabolically flexible and metabolically healthy, you don't need to do as many mitochondrial stressors because you already have achieved the thing that you're going for. So that was something that was kind of interesting, for me, was realizing like, there's a point where biohacking gets you to a new place of health, and you don't actually need to do the same things you were doing before. You don't need to do, like, I don't need to do as much fasting anymore. I still do somewhere between 12 to 14 hours, depending on the day, but I don't need to do as much anymore because I've got better blood sugar metabolism. And, that's something people need to realize, is like, it's a tool in the toolbox. If you have blood sugar issues, it's a great tool for getting better liver insulin sensitivity, but it's not necessarily something you need to do constantly unless you're really feeling like you're benefiting from it. You know, sometimes, an occasional fasting mimicking diet can be really great. I've got a lot of women in my practice who do the Prolon, and they do it like quarterly, and it works great for them. They're going through perimenopause or menopause. But young, fertile, healthy females who are metabolically healthy, you don't really need to do a lot of fasting. And so it's trying to like teach people there's a time and a place for things. And if you are struggling with obesity and sedentary behavior, and you want to optimize your metabolic health, a little bit of fasting is a great first step, but like, it's not the only thing you can do to optimize.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I definitely have an experience with fasting as well. And I did way too much fasting when I started. First of all, at the time, I was still suffering for quite a lot of migraines. I have a history of chronic migraine. I was
Oh,
still
yeah.
suffering from migraines. And I just fasted because I'm like, because it's healthy, because you need
Yeah.
it. I mean, I didn't need it actually. It was actually, well, what happened is that I guess naturally I started paying more attention on what I ate when I ate it. So
Yeah.
in that sense, it was good. At the same time, I reduced a lot of these fast spiking carbs and everything. So that actually, at the end of the day, it did improve my health with migraines,
Yeah.
which I don't suffer from anymore. But what happened is also I messed up with my hormones quite efficiently
Yeah.
at the time. And
Yeah.
then when I got rid of, or when I had been able to somehow optimize my migraines a little bit better, then came the other challenge, which I was self-causing for myself. And yeah, then just like realizing that actually, fasting is not, it's not a race. You don't have to think that the more I fast, the better I am. Actually, yeah, like there are definitely certain times of the month that I wouldn't fast anymore. Like I wouldn't fast near ovulation or at the end of the menstrual cycle, just because I'm gonna
Yeah.
start losing blood and nutrients and everything, and I want to be prepared for that. And yeah, I mean, blood sugar is very interesting as a
Blood sugar is
topic.
key.
Yeah, let's talk about that because I think that's a thing that everyone needs to understand if they want to optimize their metabolic health, and maybe
Yeah.
start with like why the blood sugar really is the key for metabolic health.
Sure. Well, the first thing I'll point out is, as someone who used to get migraines when I was in medical school, I mean, I was skipping meals, I was drinking a lot of coffee, and I was really suffering from migraines. And it wasn't until I realized the relationship between magnesium and meal timing and blood sugar regulation that I really was able to heal from migraines.
Oh my God,
And
I
it
love
was
magnesium.
magnesium is so important, but a lot of people don't get that blood sugar regulation is a huge it plays a huge role in migraine formation. So if you're like, I mean, fasting is certainly great for helping to improve blood sugar, but if you're already lean and you're already healthy and your issue is migraines, like the thing that I would recommend first and foremost is would be putting on a blood sugar monitor and actually seeing if your blood sugar is stable throughout the day. Because somebody who's lean and like getting migraines, you might actually be one of those people who's just you're not maintaining proper blood sugar. You know, it's not uncommon for people who have really fast metabolisms to need to eat more than they realize. And at the same time, there's a lot of people with really, you know, with metabolic inflexibility, overweight, obesity in America. And oftentimes their issue is more insulin resistance and actually having higher blood sugar levels. So I kind of look at women's bodies like there's and not just women's bodies, but just if you look at biology, when we become disordered, we become often like we often become like too big or too small, right? Or we become like too reactive or shut down. So like the nervous system often reacts to stress by reactivity or shutdown. And like this is kind of like the simplest way to describe like our nervous system. Or if you are balanced, then tend to befriend, right? That's the sort of ventral vagal response. So in women, when it comes to metabolism, you often see, you know, problems with underweight and underconsumption of food and low blood sugar. Lots of like a lot of women who I know who are too stressed out, they undereat, their body fat drops too low, their fertility is impaired, their period stops,
And
and their
that
blood
was
sugar.
totally me before. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was you. So you probably had what's called relative energy deficiency, and it's also known as RED S, relative energy deficiency of sport. It's when women are undereating for their exercise levels. And as a result, they like become energy deficient. And so their bodies say, you can't have a baby right now. There's not enough energy. So why are we going to let you commit resources to that? You need to stay alive. So it's like, I'm going to keep you alive. And like the migraines are almost like the alarm system to your body. That's like, something is wrong. You need to pay attention. So I love like looking at the body from the lens of adaptation, because when you see it that way, it's not like you did anything wrong. It's that your body's trying to protect you. Your body's trying to help you adapt, right?
I love that. I love that what you just said. If you have pain, if you have conditions, if you have anxiety, depressed mood, it's not that you are not doing something wrong, but your body is trying to protect you.
Your body's trying to protect
you. But
you
should listen. Yeah.
Yeah, you got to listen to it. Like last
night. That's an empowering self-compassion phrase, really.
It is. And it's also like you have to start honoring your body's intelligence because your body is so smart. It's so smart. It's like, I'm going to keep you alive so that, and like, I'm not going to not have a baby right now because I'm mad at you. I'm not letting you have a baby right now because I want you to stay alive. And it's like trying to protect you. So your body has this beautiful protection mechanism in it at all times. It's so cool how it does this. But at the same time, as I gained like 10 pounds during the pandemic and I've lost it, thank God. But when I had gained it, I was like, this really sucks. I was really, really hard on myself. I was really self-critical. I was really like unhappy and just like, why am I? I'm like, I feel so fat. And I was also very estrogen dominant. So when you gain weight and you develop heavy periods and you develop like really, I had a lot of, I was drinking way too much coffee again. So fortunately I weaned off of coffee and I developed this coffee detox program with Mudwater. It's a great program actually. I just went through it again. It's awesome. But basically I became estrogen dominant because I had gained weight and I added body fat and I had created more, I mean, I was producing more hormones because my body had more, you know, your body needs fat to make hormones. And so my body had a lot of extra fat. So my body had a lot of extra hormones and you have aromatase in your fat cells that produces estrogen. And so I was like, really annoyed at the time, but then I was like, well, why is my body doing this to me? And I was like, oh, my body is trying to protect me to keep me alive. My body wants me to gain weight, but my body's keeping the weight on because it's a protective mechanism for stress. It's like the first thing you do when you're under a lot of stress is you like try to find energy to survive. So when you look at the body going that way, it's like, oh, I'm just eating more because my body is stressed out and my body wants to survive. And it's like, okay, all this makes sense. And so when you look at it that way, you're like, that wasn't really like a problem. That was just a survival mechanism. And so a lot of women just don't see their bodies this way. They just get really mad at their bodies and they're really unkind to themselves. Mm-hmm. And actually what we need in both cases is like, we just need to look at ourselves and just be like, oh my God, I'm here for you. I know you're struggling, but I'm like, I've got you, you know? And I'm like, we're going to get through this. And you got to talk to yourself with such kindness and compassion because it's, we're under so much stress and there's so many reasons to be stressed out. And so, you know, like there's a time and a place for, you know, challenging yourself. And I did work out pretty consistently during the pandemic. I did weightlift pretty much the whole time. And, you know, I do think that exercise is one of the best ways that you can handle stress. It's like really good way to get extra anxious energy out of your body. We just don't want to over-exercise, right? And we don't want to under-exercise. We want to like just right. So I've had clients who exercise 7 days a week and they come to me with hormone dysfunction. And I'm like, you might want to just like cut back to like 5 days a week. And they're like, oh my God, my hormones are improving. Everything's getting better. And at the same time, I've seen people who are sedentary who've had migraines and I'm like, well, how many steps are you taking per day? And they're like, oh, like 2000. I'm like, you need to move your body. Your body needs to move. Like you got to get your body to move. So again, when people are under threat and stress or we have trauma, there's often a hyperactive response or a hypoactive response. Some people shut down. Some people don't move their bodies enough. Some people move their bodies too much. So this is really one of the sort of simpler ways to see health is like your body is just trying to regulate and it can get dysregulated if we get stuck on one end of the pole. You know, we really want to find the balance point in the beginning, in the middle.
Yeah, I love that. One thing that came into my mind is that, as you said, women, we end up often like maybe hate is a hard word, but okay, might be hating our bodies for having some pain or something. That's the moment when you need to love it more. And that's what I actually talked about in my so when I was studying, I got the chance to give a TEDx talk on how I started using meditation and this kind of like a self-love aspect on managing migraines or managing the stress with migraines. And what the key message there was for me is that, okay, my body is going through pain and I'm not going to turn against this. It's not like me against my body, what we often end up thinking when we have some health issues. Exactly, more normal to have pain and aches and flus and these kind of things in your body than not ever to have anything that would make you feel pain or sadness. So when you are under pain, or when you have health issues, you turn into like, okay, I'm hearing you and I'm loving you more because of this. And I love you because you are now in pain. So you need more of my attention and more of that compassion. So I think that was very good point that you raised up. So thank you for that.
Yeah. Yeah, then, it's key to learn to be compassionate. And like, I'm actually going through a training program for trauma right now called MindLight. And one of the biggest things that you can do when you're really under a lot of stress is just tapping, you know, like tapping your acupressure points on your chin, on your third eye area, right here by your sternum. And you can just do affirmations and mantras. And it's a really great way to just like get the extra energy out of the body through these acupressure points. It really, really helps. Surprising how it just kind of like shifts your body's energy. But another thing that you can do is when you're really struggling, you're feeling a lot of really deep tension in the body and a lot of emotion, you can bring in a memory of something that's really beautiful, like a place in the world that you've been to that makes you feel totally loved and connected. And like, for me, it's like this family lake house that I go to. And when you go into that place and you feel super, super, super loved and connected to people, and you get to the spot, you can bring in that loving connection into the memory that you're, or into the, like, you can bring that loving memory into the present moment and almost envelop the anxiety in love and transform it. And it's a practice. I mean, it's definitely a practice. It just doesn't happen overnight, but the more you can practice, like developing, forget, like just really cultivating things like forgiveness, cultivating self-compassion, cultivating hope, cultivating like a lot of these sort of spiritual virtues, the more that you can actually like change your mind, which will change your reality. And I'm really obsessed with like all the stuff that you can do with mindset, because I think there's a lot, I mean, breath work and just like really mental fitness practices can be some of the most powerful things to shift your reality.
Great. Yeah, I agree. Of course, I'm a psychologist, so I agree. And so let's talk a little bit more about insulin. So insulin is, I feel like it's a little bit confusing for people, because I get like, I'm doing CGM experiments all the time. I actually just put CGM monitor yesterday again, just like out of curiosity. And also because I'm trying to, of course, balance my blood glucose. And I often get questions on, hey, what about fruits? Hey, what about proteins? Hey, what about sweeteners? So what I think is why are insulin spikes bad? Like, why do we want to avoid them? Maybe that's where we need to start from.
I mean, I would say blood sugar spikes in particular, what you want to be thinking about, because every time you spike your blood sugar, and by the way, I'm not perfect. I definitely still get blood sugar spikes occasionally. Like, so
I think we are all too. I mean,
you don't want to be like so crazy about food that you like are no longer human. But if you're getting these big spikes regularly, basically oftentimes that's a reflection of what you're eating or your baseline insulin sensitivity. So I have put my body under more stress this year than I can remember in the recent past. I mean, I was like, I literally fundraised, taught at Stanford, and moved, traveled to multiple countries. And I've been like building my startup, finishing and marketing my book, seeing patients and advising like 15 companies. Wow. So it is a lot. It is not healthy. I'm not recommending this. But insulin resistance is definitely going to happen if you have high cortisol. So I got my cortisol tested because I was looking at my blood sugar and I was like, uh-oh, this is why my blood sugar is not so good right now. I got to get my insulin sensitivity under control. Blood sugar spikes, you know, these are basically what happens to you when you eat food or you're in the setting of insulin resistance. And the food causes your blood sugar to go super physiologic levels. And typically when that happens, your body will pump out more insulin. And the body pumps out more insulin because it wants to put the blood sugar away, because blood sugar is not supposed to be in your high blood sugar is not good for your body. And the reason why is it actually creates oxidative stress in the mitochondria. And oxidative stress is kind of like pollution. And that pollution affects your lining of your blood vessels. And this is part of the mechanism of why high blood sugar contributes to heart disease, is it damages blood vessels. And when you damage your blood vessels, your body has to go repair that damage. So it causes inflammation, oxidative stress, and the body takes LDL cholesterol and it starts patching up the injured blood vessel wall. And then HDL, you know, its job is to basically, so one of the things that can happen to people is like when you eat packaged processed foods that are high in blood sugar, like high, that cause your blood sugar to spike, you're eating foods that are also really bad for your microbiome. So fast food, processed foods are often the biggest culprits, like soda, candy, pizzas, pastries, pastas. Like a lot of these high carb foods are, and refined carb foods are, and high sugar foods often are like the biggest culprits for blood sugar spikes. And a lot of the really processed, packaged, ultra processed foods are also really bad for your microbiome. And when your microbiome has a lot of influence over your blood sugar metabolism. And so if you mess up your microbiome, you're also going to likely see problems with metabolism. You typically see high cholesterol and you see high blood sugar. So there's a lot of activity going on here, right? You have to look at metabolism holistically, from gut health to mitochondrial health, to what you eat, to the set, to the amount of stress that you have, to how you're using the energy. But getting back to this whole thing about heart disease and diabetes, when you have gut dysbiosis from a diet that's really ultra processed Western diet, which is the majority of the world is starting to eat this way, and we're starting to see more and more chronic metabolic diseases, what happens is you end up getting lipopolysaccharide into the bloodstream from the microbiome, and it gets through, you know, the mucosal wall and mucosal barrier is affected by these ultra processed foods. And as a result, when you get that lipopolysaccharide into the bloodstream, your body has to do something about it. It causes systemic inflammation. And systemic inflammation does contribute to insulin resistance as well. So I'm giving you like a bunch of different ways of like how your diet can affect your blood sugar. But when your blood sugar spikes, your blood sugar damages your blood vessels and the blood vessels have to be repaired. And so oftentimes we actually have higher lipid levels in our bodies when we have gut dysbiosis. And those high lipid levels are actually adaptive because they're trying to actually deal with the lipopolysaccharide released from the ultra processed foods that have screwed up the lining of your blood, of your microbiome. Wow. And so there's this like, there's this like whole, I basically just like, I feel like I figured out why people get metabolic disease through understanding what Western diets do to the gut, how those diets cause leaky gut, how those diets cause lipopolysaccharide to get into the bloodstream, and how that extra LDL is not, it's basically an adaptive response to the inflammation, to the lipopolysaccharide, trying to remove that, and also trying to repair the lining of the blood vessel. And HDL, good cholesterol, is often goes down because it's like, it's trying to adapt to all of the dysfunction, you know? And so like LDL is going in, trying to patch up the blood vessel. HDL is trying to actually remove that lipopolysaccharide. I believe that's the mechanism. And so your LDL goes up, your HDL goes down, your inflammation goes up from the diet and from the mitochondria being taxed. Your oxidative stress goes up from the high carb foods. And like the oftentimes the mitochondria has, what's called, It's like a traffic jam when you have high fat, high carb foods. So now you have this mitochondrial traffic jam where the substrate can't get into the cell. And it's like all of this makes sense if you actually just look at it from first principles. So it's, I didn't do a great job explaining it, but I think that there is a pretty simple explanation of why people end up with metabolic disease. And it's not just about eating too many carbs and eating too much sugar. It's also the dysbiosis in the gut and how that throws off lipid balance. And when you, I see that to be much more of an issue for a lot of people than we realize. And so in the book, I talk a lot about gut health and how you really have to optimize gut health to optimize metabolic health. It's not enough just to cut out all the refined carbs. It's not enough to cut out all the refined sugar. You have to fix the gut if you want to fix the lipids and if you want to reduce the inflammation. And inflammation, oxidative stress, hyperlipidemia, low HDL, high blood sugar, and as a result, hypertension from those damaged blood vessels that get too stiff. This is metabolic disease. This is metabolic disease 101. And no one taught it to me this way. Like nobody taught this to me this way. And I was like, how is that possible that like we have this, like we don't have a solid framework for why people are getting super sick. And so I think I figured it out. I think it makes a lot of sense. It took me a long time to figure it out. But if you really want to get metabolically healthy, you have to take out the things in the diet that are causing dysbiosis, packaged processed foods, the fast foods, and you have to take out the things that are causing those blood sugar spikes, which is the refined carbs or refined sugar. And you have to really nurture the gut to lower that inflammation because your immune system is in your gut. And you got to take care of those blood vessels. And so, exercise is really, really key for using the fuel, not letting those substrates build up. You got to use the fuel. And then you also got to take care of those blood vessels by making sure that you don't live in a polluted area. You purify your air, and you really try to avoid those big blood sugar spikes.
I love that. That was a very thorough explanation. And one key thing, or like one reminder that I really want to now bring into this discussion is that if you ever ate antibiotics in your life, make sure that you test your gut microbiome, because it's what I didn't do for years after eating antibiotics. Then I did a GI map years later. And my good friend, who is also a functional doctor, told me that, well, I can see that you have had dysbiosis, but you've recovered from it, because probably because of your diet and some things that you did. I ate seed probiotics, and I did a lot of things for the gut. But yeah, never occurred to me that this could have actually had an implication also on my blood sugar levels,
Well,
for
it's
sure.
so interesting, right? Like people don't see these connections, but like one of HDL's role is to bind lipopolysaccharide and to remove it from the bloodstream. And when you look at that, when I see people who have really low HDL, I immediately think they have gut dysfunction. They have gut dysbiosis. Now, I had to take antibiotics last year, and it sucks because you do your gut test and you're like, oh my God, I don't have enough good bacteria left. So you, I mean, like I'm a big fan of probiotics if you need them. Not everybody needs to take them, but I needed them. And so I take BioOptimizer's brand of probiotics. They have some of the best gut health products in the market. When people buy my book, they can actually get access to these protocols that I have on my website. I'm going to be posting all these like gut optimization protocols because everybody just needs to learn how to use enzymes. Like I have my Masszymes on my table. I
Oh my God, I love
love
those. I love that
enzymes.
stuff.
Yeah, they work. I mean, it's the best enzymes on the market. And what else? Yeah. So like when people look at when people look at like blood fats, they often look and say, oh, I should just cut all the cholesterol out of my diet. And it's like, no, you need to look at like what you're eating. Are you getting enough fruits and vegetables? Are you actually feeding the microbiome? There's this whole carnivore world. And I'm like, I just don't think you can, I just don't think a life without vegetables makes sense. Like, I think vegetables are part of, like, I think they're really important for gut health, for fiber. And like a lot of people who've destroyed their guts go carnivore and they're like, oh, I found the solution. It's like, no, you've just found a way to deal with the fact that you have a really screwed up microbiome and you haven't fixed your microbiome. You've basically just like removed the thing that's irritating it, but you didn't fix the actual problem. So I'm really a big believer in the omnivore diet, like pretty basic. like meat, vegetables, nuts, seeds, fruits is like mostly what I eat. I do have some legumes on occasion. Sometimes I'll eat grain, but not very often. I just don't do well with a lot of grain, but like plenty of people do. But I got a really bad start to my microbiome when I was a kid. I had lots of antibiotics as a child. And so I have a lot more sensitive of a gut. I have to be a lot more careful.
Yeah, I'm the same. I had a lot of antibiotics as a child, and yeah, just like even now, even no matter how much I eat probiotics and stuff like that, I still have sensitive stomach. But I mean, I've learned to live with it, and I also have a heavily plant-based diet. I don't do well with a lot of red meat, for example. It just doesn't feel good in my body. But yeah, I mean, I take sure or make sure that I will get all the proteins and everything, you know. What I need the nutrients. I think that's the key. You know, it's like we go into this, oh, should I eat proteins or animal meat or carb or fat? Or it's like you need nutrients. You don't need certain food categories, but you need to make sure that you get the nutrients. That's my philosophy. So yeah, what are your like best hacks? I would like to, because we are biohackers, so hacks for managing insulin and blood sugar spikes.
I would say that, I mean, the big one is I really try to avoid sugar. I had like half a teaspoon of honey today. But I really just I do put a l I make my own nut butters and I use a little bit of coconut sugar in my nut butters, but I definitely try to avoid a lot of sugar. So very minimal sugar intake. I don't completely eliminate it, but I don't like overdo it like I used to. I used to eat way too much sugar.
Do
And then
you like time the sugar somehow after proteins, or do you do that?
yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely best to A, just make sure you're not getting a large glycemic load. Meal timing is really key. So like if you are going to eat carbohydrates, you want to eat them last. And you want to eat your vegetables first and then your protein second. And that can really like lower the glycemic response. There are great supplements out there that I take. Glycolog by Blackstone Labs is a really good insulin. They call it an insulin mimetic and nutrient partitioning agent, but it has cinnamon, berberine, bitter melon, geymena, chromium, bioperine, and like an ALA. Which is all of these are great for metabolism. So if I'm going to eat a higher carb meal, I like love glycolog. I also, believe in walking after meals. Wegovy is a big one people are doing these days. I just started taking it because I was like, why not? If it exists, why not try semaglutide? It's a GLP-1 inhibitor. I'm just experimenting with it right now. I want to see what it does. And yeah, I think like other ones would be, I mean, I have a whole list of things on how to like use blood sugar monitoring to change your numbers. So like there's a whole list of how to like basically the book explains how people can hack their blood sugar by using a blood sugar monitor. So the first thing you need to do is find out if you have a problem. And then you go and you figure out what kind of problem you have. So is it high fasting blood sugar? Is it high post-meal blood sugar? Is it high glycemic variability? And is it high stress that's causing this? Exercise is fantastic for, blood sugar metabolism. So getting to the gym a few days a week is really important. Walking, simply just getting more neat, that's really key.
Yeah, I mean, I noticed a big difference in my blood sugar response to food and meals when I started doing. I do like a protocol. Basically, every time before I eat, I do a little bit of movement, especially if I have been sitting down or stagnant. So I do something like, I don't know. I love these like 5 to 10 minutes dance workouts at YouTube. I probably should not say it this publicly, but I do like dance at home before meal. And then after
I
the
love
food,
that.
yeah, and then do maybe some glute core activation, like a plank, like a 1 minute plank, and that's it. Like that really helps already. I may take some apple cider vinegar. I do Swedish bitters as well, like just bitter herbs before the food. And then after food, I do the same thing. I actually have a walking treadmill in my office, and so I might go to do something at the computer and I walk at the same time. Especially at the winter when it's like cold outside, and after dinner you really don't want to go out walking. But even just like 10 minutes of walk is like a very good for the blood sugar response. So I think those like a It doesn't require a huge investment of time or energy to start doing these little hacks, but it can make such a big impact on your
Yeah,
overall blood sugar.
totally. Totally agree.
What would you say are the implications of like stress to insulin, and how does all that come together?
Well, very simply, when we are stressed, we release cortisol, and cortisol's job is to keep you alive and get you out of danger. And so, as well as adrenaline and norepinephrine, which also help release. You know, basically these stress hormones help release nutrients so that our body can escape danger. So we try to shunt blood sugar to the brain. Cortisol makes us insulin resistant on purpose so that we can shunt the blood sugar to the brain so we can get out of danger. The problem is we're not supposed to be under chronic stress. So chronic stress can lead to chronically high cortisol levels, which I'm experiencing. And that's part of the reason why I'm on a lot of adaptogens right now. To lower my cortisol response, I'm like giving myself lots of sleep, lots of recovery, not too much intense exercise, giving myself just more, just giving myself the opportunity to like be easier on myself, you know? And yeah, so long story short, basically, when we have low cortisol levels, when we get burned out, what can happen is actually we struggle to maintain our blood sugar. We struggle to maintain our blood pressure, and we often get really dizzy when we stand up, and we often feel really terrible in the morning, really fatigued, because cortisol normally rises in the morning to give you this. It rises in the morning to give you a bit of energy. You know, it's supposed to help you start your day. It's supposed to have a diurnal rhythm. And when people are chronically stressed over many, many, many months, what can happen is the cortisol will have negative feedback. And it will start to actually the negative feedback will start to create a lower cortisol state. And so basically, like I've described before, like the body out of balance often has too high or too low of something. So cortisol too high is like you're stressed, you're anxious, you're tired, you're wired, and you just feel really edgy in the morning. But low cortisol is when you feel exhausted, fatigued, just no energy, can't get out of bed, get dizzy when you stand up, and you can't get your blood sugar stable. And so when somebody's high cortisol, they definitely need to be very careful with what they're eating, very consistent at times, watch your carbs because you're going to have bigger spikes. But when you're low cortisol, you need to have really consistent meal timing throughout the day because that is going to create a lot more stable blood sugar levels. And if you're healthy and somewhere in the middle and your cortisol is normal and you're healthy and stable, that's the best time to start like testing your body with ketosis, with cyclical ketosis, a little bit of fasting. That's when it works best, is when you're in a state of balance, because that'll make you stronger. But when you're high or low cortisol, you got to be really careful because you might have high or low blood sugar.
Okay. Thanks for that. And the concluding question is, what is something that maybe like as a lens of a woman, you would have told to your younger self, a younger self, as a piece of advice right now, with this all knowledge and the information that you have?
You have got to stop being so hard on yourself. And you're beautiful the way you are. You don't need to change. You're perfect. Like, I would have been so much, you can be confident. You don't need to prove yourself so much, you know? I was so insecure when I was younger. And I still, you know, I feel a lot better about, I have a lot more authentic self-confidence now, a lot of really authentic self-love, but I take criticism way too, I'm a little sensitive to criticism, which is cool with, that are high achievers. So, cause you just have, I mean, like nobody's going to be harder on myself than me, but learning self-compassion and learning to just be to yourself. And I think I would have told myself, you don't need to be afraid to share your knowledge. You know enough to share what you have. I was like, it wasn't until I started teaching at Stanford that I got really confident that I could build a brand because I was like, okay, if I'm good enough to teach at an Ivy League, I must be good enough to teach other people. But it was really before I taught at Stanford, I really didn't fully feel like I could, I didn't feel like I was like I knew enough. And like everyone's like, Molly, you know so many things about so many topics. Like, what are you talking about? But I really feel like I felt the need to overcompensate a lot when I was younger, because I was like, there's a lot of self-doubt, you know, a lot of like, well, I feel like I know what I'm else is where I'm at yet. And like, there was a lot of sense of, I felt like I knew I was ahead of the curve, but because when you're ahead of the curve by many, many years, it can feel really lonely, and you doubt what you know, because you seem to be doing things that other people think is weird, and you don't trust yourself because you're like one of the few people doing them. So like blood sugar monitoring, I was like super obsessed with it early on, like 2014. And yet I didn't trust myself to build a company at the time, because I was like, everyone thought I was kind of nuts, you know, and now everyone's building companies in the space. So you got to learn, if you really think you're onto something and you really think you understand something, trust yourself and go for it, and don't have so much self-doubt. I would have told myself all of that in the past, but at the same time, everything in divine timing, you know?
Thank you so much. I hope everyone take note of that and, you know, stamp it in their bathroom wall and see that every day, because trust yourself is a very powerful, very golden piece of advice. Thank you so much. Where can people find you?
Well, my Instagram, at drmolly.co. Website, www.drmolly.co, drmolly.co. And yeah, that's about it. I mean, you can find me out like on Twitter and LinkedIn at Molly Maloof MD as well. So those are the best places to find me.
Yes, and all the women who want to know a lot more about biohacking and where to start, check out Molly's book.
Yeah, Spark Factor.
Thank you for listening. I'd love to hear what questions and ideas you got from today's episode, so leave a comment on YouTube and let me know about you. If you liked this episode, please leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcast. This also helps with podcast ranking and visibility. If you know someone who might benefit from listening to today's episode, consider sharing it with them and spreading health. Looking forward to having you around next time as well. Subscribe to get notified on the next episode. See you next time at the same place. Have a great rest of the week.